On the Limb with Dr. Nicola Bird in partnership with Beauty and Wellness TV, your one stop for leading a happy, healthy, and successful life, celebrating life and illuminating mind, heart, body, and soul.
Welcome, welcome. I am Dr. Nicola Bird. I am a psychotherapist and I am the founder of Self-Imaging Therapy. Thank you all for being here with me today. I am just so happy to be here, celebrating life, illuminating mind, heart, body, and soul with this show. And the theme of today's show is the power of perception. Wow, always a powerful thing. It's so much what we have within our own hands to create the change that and empower ourselves in our life. And we will explore the power of perception on our path to happiness, confidence, success, and wellness. And so I'm particularly thrilled to introduce my first very special guest, clinical psychologist, author, and consultant, Dr. Jonah Packett. Dr. Jonah specializes in the areas of happiness, well-being, and positive psychology, and is the author of the recently released self-help book, Real Happiness, Proven Paths for Contentment, Peace, and Well-Being. We all want that, for sure. He's about to talk about the 7 proven paths to happiness and well-being. Welcome, welcome, Dr. Jonah. I'm happy to have you. So there we go. We're starting off on a great note.
And I am happy to be on. Thank you so much for having me on today. It's a great honor.
Well, it's a certain honor to have you and talk about all what real happiness, because, I mean, it's so much of what people are seeking. I mean, the lens through which we look at the world really determines the world that we experience, and there are so many ways that we can look at the world, and
absolutely,
and they factor into what forms that create the reality of our existence. And if we are pessimistic versus optimistic, for instance, mm-hmm. it'll really change. I mean, pessimism has shown to lower levels of depression, higher levels of self-esteem, improved physical health. I mean, so mind-body stuff, and I know you've done a lot of research in your book, Real Happiness. So, mm-hmm. and you have over 35 scientifically validated practices and skills to help create happiness for us in your book. So that's what we want to hear about. How can we create more happiness based on what you have researched?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. You hit a few things on the head there that I just definitely want to highlight. Number one being that this is something that we all want, and you know it seems very obvious on one level, but survey after survey shows that you know personal happiness is right at the top of the list of what people want most in life. And we live in a world where, in many ways, we have it easier than our ancestors in terms of material abundance, in terms of so much that centuries ago would have been seen as luxuries are now commonplace today. And yet, despite having so much at our fingertips, it seems that rates of personal happiness, according to studies, have stagnated and in some cases even gone backwards. So it's something that we all want, and yet it seems like it's becoming harder to achieve. So what I wanted to do in writing this book was create an easy-to-use manual, something that gives the science behind happiness, but also the how-tos behind it.
Okay, well, that's very juicy for sure, and it begs starting with, so what first is some of the scientific studies that behind happiness, because I think that's really important for us to understand that, because it's not anecdotal, which is what's so interesting about your book. It's not just anecdotal references to be happy by doing this or doing that. You actually have some real substantiated claims.
Yes.
Things that are working. Yeah.
Absolutely. And that's what I wanted to really put forth in this book. You know, this is something that there's obviously a lot of books on the topic, a lot of wisdom dating back centuries, hundreds of years in many cases, ideas about what creates a happy life. But it's actually very difficult to look at it from a scientific standpoint of what does and what doesn't make a big difference when it comes to our personal happiness. And finding the truth when it comes to that can be pretty tough for people. It can kind of feel like you're looking for a needle in a haystack sometimes with all the books and magazines and blogs out there. So what I wanted to really look at was, what does the science say matters? What do we mean when we say happiness? Because, again, even the word happiness is kind of a loaded one. It means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And so to put that into terms that can be studied was one of the first tasks that a lot of researchers had to do, and really looking at it in terms of layers. So there's kind of a positive emotion, that's the happiness that we all kind of think of when we think of happiness, but really a deeper sense of meaning, of purpose, of connection to the people and things around us, to our work, to our passions, and that's really what they're looking at when it comes to happiness.
That's what's being defined as happiness.
Yes, to kind of define that. But it begs the question of whether that's something that can really be changed or not. And believe it or not, even that question over the years has been a little bit controversial. You know, for years it was thought that, you know, you could become momentarily happier for a brief time, but then you'd kind of fall back to baseline. There's been some very interesting studies even done on lottery winners. We'd all want to win the lottery, obviously. But within about 6 months of winning the lottery, the average lottery winner is back to where they started in terms of personal happiness. And on the flip side, kind of the opposite group, people that have been through horrible accidents, lost the use of their arms or legs, we would expect that their happiness would be ruined for life. But studies show the exact opposite, that about 6 months later, they're back to baseline. So this kind of yo-yo, kind of returning to baseline, made people think that you couldn't increase happiness. And what they're finding now is that about half of our happiness level is based on things like our genes, based on genetics. About half is out of our control. But the things we really expect to make a big difference, you know, where do we live, how much money do we earn, what kind of car do we drive, what do we do for work, that only makes up about 10%. And a whole 40% is left over in terms of our internal habits, our behaviors, our practices that can really make a difference in terms of happiness.
So just so that I think the listeners are clear, so what you're saying is that, so we return to baseline. Mm-hmm. You're saying that we can, whatever our baseline is, mm-hmm. we can change that.
Yes, we can boost our baseline as long as we're practicing sort of the things that make a difference. And by kind of the seven paths that I talk about in my book, for example, gratitude, practicing kindness, mindfulness, self-compassion, cultivating connection, forgiveness, and optimism. Those seven are seven of the most well-studied, well-researched paths towards lastingly boosting our baseline. The problem that people run into is that the things that we often think and expect will make us happy don't in the long run. And so we expend a lot of energy doing things like, you know, figuring out how to get more money in our bank account, how to move into that bigger house down the road, how to drive that dream car. And those things feel good in the moment, but it's very fleeting. It dissipates. And then
I got that when you were talking about like the lottery winner example, because when you get a new toy, it's like a kid at Christmas time. They get a new toy, they're thrilled for a minute or two, and then they forget the toy, it's over with.
Exactly.
Very much like that when we're getting these external things to try and fill up. And so you're coming back to that age-old message that it's some that it is within us, that it's something that we have to something we nurture within us, and that doing that work is what allows us to shift from our baseline.
Precisely. I mean, I really think of happiness as a skill, as a practice state of mind, rather than something that just happens to us. And so it does take that same sort of practice, the way we would any new skill, to become lastingly happier. But it's very possible if we're practicing it in the right way.
So we'll talk. I wanted to ask about the 40% that you say is our genes, for instance, right? Genetics.
So about 50% are genes,
50%, okay. So 50% is our genes. And I was actually, I recently read, I can't remember what it was, where they're talking about the specific gene and this percentage of the population that actually has it. And as a result, they are not inclined towards addiction at all. It's 30%. Mm-hmm. And because they have an intrinsic kind of buzz that would be mimic.
Yep.
And high, and in fact, that if we... that as a, and I mean, I have never been interested in substances at all. I don't drink. I never liked any of those things. And they say people who actually are like that find the opposite effect from. So then you have those. So my question to that, and why I'm elongating that, is if you have, like you say, hey, you don't have that gene as much plugged in, is it harder to make that shift?
Yes. So, I mean, and that's where the genes come in, you know, and it's probably, it is more complicated than a single gene expression, for example, you know, much like kind of personality, temperament, whether we're predisposed to depression or not, there's a combination of things going on. But, you know, we all know people, for example, that happiness, they tend to be very upbeat no matter what seems to happen. And they kind of tend to be the ones that are pretty, have it a little bit easier when it comes to being happy and finding happiness. And then other people, it's more of a struggle. They're maybe a little more more of a tendency towards depression, towards melancholy, for example. And it might take a little bit of more work because their genes make it that much more of an uphill struggle. So there's definitely individual differences. It's easier for some people than others. But the exciting part of the research to me is that there's a whole 40% there, almost half, that is under our control to change starting today, that we can all be happier tomorrow than we are today and happier in a year than we are today.
I love that. I love that because that's so empowering. And I think, and you mentioned something that when you talk about what genes are being expressed, which I think is the powerful part, too, for people to understand that even with a genetic composition, you can it's what genes get expressed. So you can learn to express through these different techniques different genes so that you are able to plug more into happiness and really cultivate it and override and overcome the melancholy or things that put you in that take you away from happiness then.
Precisely. And so we're not kind of doomed to either what our genes determine or the circumstances around us. There's actually a lot of internal work, internal shifts, the way that we think, the way that we act, the choices that we make, our behaviors that have a huge impact in terms of boosting our well-being.
So give us some of what those, I mean, you told us, you mentioned them. So if you were to sum up, what would you think would be the top three, let's say? And I know that's, I mean, you have seven paths, granted, but.
Yeah, so I have seven, and what I tried to do there was to really look at the research objectively, to look at all the different ideas that have been put out there and look at, choose the ones that have the most support, the most number of studies with the largest number of individuals, in terms of creating lasting well-being and happiness. So, you know, part of it is an individual journey of figuring out which of these seven, for example, really resonate for you. There's a lot of individual differences. You know, for certain people, mindfulness is really a key that unlocks a life of well-being and contentment. For other people, it's more kind of cultivating those connections between people, fostering those interpersonal relationships, and happiness really developing between rather than within. And for others, it would be, you know, really cultivating an attitude of gratitude, as cheesy as that sounds, of kind of really learning to notice and appreciate the good things that are existing in all of our lives. It's so easy to go on autopilot and focus on the negative. And our brains are even kind of developed to do that on certain levels. So we have to fight back against that tendency through our intention and through really noticing those good things. So there's different answers. I would say for me personally, the skills of kind of the paths of fostering gratitude, engaging in acts of kindness, and practicing mindfulness would be the three that really stand out for me. But the differences among people are such that, you know, that the answer might be different for you and for the next person.
I find that very interesting because we then find our way of being with this. And when you were talking about that, I was personalizing some of it and thinking that, you know, because mindfulness has been such a whole part of my life. Mm-hmm. But then now that I've done that a lot, then I find that now I've moved towards more connections because I've kind of, you know, it's not a mastering of it, but it's so integrated kind of in my lifestyle that I don't have to work so much at that, right?
Yeah,
so then it's like it opens up another door, and then so then I'm actualizing more happiness through that way, whereas before I might have been more internalized.
Absolutely, and I think that's a great point too. Is, you know, it's like when we're learning how to drive for the first time. There's, you know, there's 30 things that we're trying to keep track of, and it feels very clunky and it feels very unnatural. And then eventually you look up one day and you're just going. And I think the same thing with these sorts of skills, these habits, is, you know, to write down three things that you're grateful for at night. At first feels very unnatural to many of us, but over time it almost becomes second nature. We just notice those things as we're going. We foster that sense of wonder and appreciation. Mm-hmm. So it does become ingrained habit.
Mm-hmm. You train your brain to be functioning in a certain way and perceive in a certain way, which is that, again, the power of perception.
Absolutely.
And so once you're focusing on that, it then becomes normalized. And that's where our power comes from, to really create the changes and really activate that happiness within us.
Yeah.
I love your message. I think your book is really just so much is what's needed, and we all need to hear more of this. So, Dr. Jonah, can you wrap it up and just give one takeaway tip for the listeners that they can, as like a final roundup for this, that they can utilize in their lives?
I would say the most important thing to remember is that, you know, happiness is not just something that feels good. It actually really is good for us as well, for our health, for our relationships, for our well-being. And it's also not something that just happens to us. It's something that we have the power to create. So it's a skill like none other, no different from any other, no different from riding a bike, no different from learning an instrument. Through practice, through dedication, we can all be a little happier moving forward.
Well, I love the empowerment message, because it gives really the understanding of that we have control over this, and just by creating disciplines in our life, we can create the changes and we can plug into real happiness. So I love it. Thank you so much. You can find out more about this amazing book, Real Happiness, Proven Paths for Contentment, Peace, and Well-Being, and all of the amazing tips. You can go to Dr. Jonah's website, Jonah Paquette, that's PAQUETTE.com. You can find his link in the message board below, so it's right there for you. And you can get the book Amazon, all the rest of the common places.
That's right.
So thank you so much for your time, your information, your wisdom, your research, and all of your contribution today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on. It's been a lot of fun, and it means a lot to me. Thank you so much, and I hope that you and your listeners pick up the book and give it a shot, and I hope to hear about it.
Wonderful. I mean, we all need a boost of real happiness, so our boost for today.
Well,
have a great day.
Thanks
again.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay,
thank
bye-bye.
You. Bye.
Well, that was good. We know that we can cultivate happiness in our lives, that it's something that we have the power to create by focusing on certain disciplines that allow us to really plug in. So we know that's what we're worth. We're worth happiness. We're worth joy. We're worth all the goodness. And we can plug in by our incredible ability to create the changes we want in our life. Always a good message. Always great news. Real happiness. And I have more ways to boost confidence coming up with my next special guest, Catherine John. She's the author of Show Up and Shine. So you want to stick around to hear more about what Catherine John is going to share with us today.
If you want the best way to heal from life challenges, get Erica Tucci's powerful book, Radiant Survivor, How to Shine and Thrive Through Recovery from Stroke, Cancer, Abuse, Addiction, and Other Life-Altering Experiences. Erica Tucci's remarkable book of healing is available now on Amazon. Find out more at www.radiantsurvivor.com.
Welcome back. You're tuned into Out on the Limb Radio with Dr. Nick the Bird. I am thrilled to introduce my next special guest, Coach Catherine Johns. Catherine is the author of Show Up and Shine, Simple Steps to Boost Your Confidence and Charisma. She will share strategies to gain confidence in our lives. Catherine, thank you so much for being here.
It is my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Confidence... loving it. We're so racked with self-doubts in our lives, and people have such critical minds, and confidence is such an important thing. But there's some really important things, because, I mean, so much, what your work, what you're doing is in terms of coaching women and work, and I've been reading about some really interesting statistics. As of 2010, women became the majority of the workforce for the first time in U.S. history. Women now hold 51.4% of managerial and professional jobs, up from 26.1% in 1980, and make up 54% of all accountants, banking, insurance, and for every two men who get a college degree, three women will do the same. So there's so much ways in which women are holding power in society, in work, at home, but at the same time, women still struggle to hold their power, and they still play small in business, which is fascinating. We've come so far, yet still stuck in some of this playing small. Catherine, how do we as women stop hiding and step into the spotlight?
Well, first of all, we take up space and we show up. And there's a huge impulse on the part of so many women to shrink. So we sit at a meeting with our colleagues and we kind of hide in the corner of our chair. We fold ourselves up. We keep our hands folded in our laps, or maybe our ankles crossed, like they taught us to sit like a nice girl when we were in grade school. And as grown women in the office, none of those things serve us well, because being the nice little girl doesn't convey power and confidence, and it doesn't get us ahead. So, you know, there's a lot of talk about this business of leaning in and taking a place at the table. What I wanted to address was some practical ways to do that.
Well, when you made that point about being nice and always being polite, I mean, that's such a female thing. And I know so many women, and I mean myself included, absolutely, that being nice, and I put that in quotation marks, and having it is such a journey to overcome, because to not be nice and to not be pleasing it can feel very uncomfortable. I know that I have felt uncomfortable, and I have learned to not feel uncomfortable, and it's still something that, oh, is that okay? And I'm like, yes, you know? So in terms of that breaking through, that being nice, so that we can, again, own our power, what shift do we need to make to, like, get over that being nice conditioning and tapes that we've been taught?
You know, I think a big part of it, Dr. Bird, is about how we show up physically. So, you know, it's partly a mindset, right? So I have to decide that I want to be respected more than I want to be liked, because sometimes it won't be
right.
But it's also been physical habits that... So when I talk about your presence, what I mean is the things that people see when they look at you, and the things people hear when you speak, and how they feel when they're around you. So when we come off with that people-pleasing thing, our presence is diminished, right? What people pick up on is that vibe that we're a little bit apologetic for our own existence in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, when I'm in a place where I'm saying, I know my stuff, and I have opinions, and my opinions are worthwhile, and in fact, I don't, well, that's another whole story, hold the thought about opinions, but when I'm in that place, people respond differently, right? They don't act like you're invisible, or they don't act like you're insignificant. They say, this is somebody who's a peer, an equal.
Wow. I mean, I think that when you're talking about that whole body language thing, and I think that that's so important. I mean, I know that in the studies, they know that the body communicates back to the brain, and when you take a certain body position, it will communicate to the brain, and the brain will perceive that reality that you are in control, that you are strong, just by different posturing.
Yep.
So that's so important, because we don't think that. We think it only just starts with our mindset, but you're including that whole body talk, basically.
Yes, because it's a feedback loop. My body tells my mind how I feel. I mean, all of that stuff about facial feedback, if you put on a smile, you'll feel happier. It turns out there's a ton of research to support that.
Yeah.
Our mind really takes on an attitude based on the physical sensation. So our body language doesn't just communicate to the people around us, it communicates to us as well.
I think it's so important because so much, there's so many just talk about, you know, mindset, and that's just, it's one directional. But we have equal power in reverse, and by tapping into that and utilizing that, we have, and becoming more aware of that, not just thinking, but really how we're presenting ourselves and becoming aware of our taking up that space. So then give me some examples, and the listeners, really, how do we, because, I mean, you know, men take up space, they spread their legs wide, they, you know what I mean, they can't take,
well, so
women
do not,
that,
yes.
You know what I mean?
So,
that's my
yes,
humor.
We're not adopting those postures, but
right.
Part of it is squaring off my shoulders and even wearing something with a seam around the shoulders. Not, you know, those days of shoulder pads like, you know, in the 80s. Those are over, thank God. But a jacket, I will look more powerful in a jacket than a sweater.
Right.
Because of the, it just gives you just a little bit of definition. So squared off shoulders, the head straight up and down, an arm out on a table or a desk or the arm of a chair as opposed to folded in my lap. Any of those little things will help me have a more solid presence without spreading myself all over the room. I don't need to go that far.
Wow. I mean, that information is so important because such small little things can have such an amazing impact and also change how we feel about ourselves in the moment. What about when women, again, like, I mean, do they feel it when they do this? Like, is there a feeling that at first we're fake, for instance? Like, I mean, I don't really feel this way, but...
Oh, I don't think that, so.
I
think it quickly becomes very natural. You know, maybe at first it takes a little effort. If I'm in the habit of sitting with my ankles crossed and my hands in my lap, and I first try to take up a little bit more space, yes, it might feel unnatural. But I've never had a client say it felt bad or icky. It's more like, like trying something out. And there's a really important piece of this, Dr. Bird, about how not just how we look, but how we sound. In fact, the reason I got into this in the first place, I was a corporate presentation skills trainer, and we would ask everybody who came into the program, what do you want to get out of this couple of days together? And over, I would hear women say, I just want people to take me seriously. But they would say it with that question mark in their voice, and they would toss their hair while they said it. Well, of course people aren't taking them seriously. So if I want to have presence, if I want to manifest confidence and charisma, I need to get rid of that kind of self-doubting, self-questioning, insecure sound and speak from my core and sound like I mean it and put a period at the end of the sentence and pause.
So, when you're talking about it not feeling, but it can be feel uncomfortable, making that change means that we need to, like, put the focus on it and be mindful of it and keep, so that we're more, like, aware of where our body is and where our voice is at. Is that how we go about really owning it and making it more real for us?
I think that's true, and I think the way to do that, you know, I always tell people if you want to develop presence, the first thing you have to do is be present. And it's about connecting with your body. You know, we walk around most of the time not connected with our body. Our energy is all up in our head and our shoulders and our neck. We're thinking, you know, a lot of people walk with their head kind of thrust forward like they're getting ahead of themselves in a literal way. And so when I actually come back into my body and what I like to do is sense my feet on the floor, my bottom in the chair, like get grounded. Every place that touches something solid, really get grounded. And when I come back to myself that way, this different sound and this different posture becomes really natural.
Well, I love what you're saying about being in the body and getting, because in my work, that's what I do, is going into the body and deep inside yourself. And so, and I absolutely with you that we're very dissociated, disconnected, and so that's really getting into our body. And I love this message because, again, there's so much talk about mindset, but you're really bringing those two together. And I agree, getting in our body is so powerful, and it gets us connected to who we are, and we can manage ourselves from that way. So that's a very powerful message. And so are there any other particular techniques that we can employ to really boosting us up?
The biggest thing is about taking up space. And the reason that I keep coming back to that is that I think it is so powerful and so practical. So if you ask me to change my mindset, I don't exactly know how to do that. Like, am I going to do affirmations?
Right.
What am I going to do? But can I put my feet on the floor and feel a little pressure and kind of feel my leg muscles turn on? Yes, I can do that. That doesn't take, it's not mysterious. It's not esoteric. It's really practical. That's why I like it.
Right. Go ahead.
One other piece I would mention is a lot of times people get mistaken and think that the only way to be charismatic is to be outgoing. And I hear people ask me about this a lot. You know, I'm kind of an introvert. I don't think I can have charisma, or I don't think I can have a big presence. And so the way I like to think about this, Dr. Bird, is that extroverts, you know, they walk in the room and they're a shiny light and they attract attention and they're warm and radiant and they shine like the sun. And introverts have a quieter, more subtle glow. They shine like the moon, but they can be just as charismatic. In fact, moonlight is in many ways way more attractive than sunlight. Yeah?
I love it.
So what do introverts do? They listen to other people. They reflect your own light back to you. That is beyond charismatic. So in terms of developing a presence with other people, that reflective listening, being present to the other person is part of the way to do that.
Well, yeah, because it really validates them and it gets them a sense of their worth and value, and that's very, very powerful because that's a basic human need, and that's very, very validating, so I can certainly see that. Well, Catherine, I've been thrilled to have you. I've loved all of the information you have provided with us and such practical ways for us to all create, boost our confidence and show up and shine, which is your book. Is there one final takeaway tip that you want to leave the listeners with to wrap it up?
I'm going to say once you take up space, this is so double-edged, but smile and let the light shine through your face. And at the same time, don't feel like you have to be smiley people-pleasy all the time. So give us that warm smile when it's natural and help us connect to you. And does that do it? Because you can't, charisma doesn't actually happen in a vacuum. People, you know, it's like the tree in the forest, right? If I'm walking around all by myself, am I charismatic? No, I'm charismatic in connection to other people. So to make that happen, you want to make that connection with other people.
Well, Catherine, thank you so much. So, listeners, you can find out more about Catherine at her website, CatherineJohns, that's with an S, .com. Her information is in the link in the message board below, so check her out. Her book, Show Up and Shine, Simple Steps to Boost Your Confidence and Charisma, is available on Amazon in paperback, Kindle version, and audiobook. So lots of ways for us to learn how we can show up and shine, and these are incredibly practical techniques and strategies that we can all utilize and certainly increase our sense of confidence. So thank you, Catherine. Amazing tips. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Talk soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Good stuff. Confidence is available to all of us, shifting our body, simple ways that we can all create change, and very empowering. We have more. Next special guest is Natalie Berthold. She's a family constellation therapist, and she's going to share more insights on how we can lead the incredible life that we deserve. Don't go anywhere. You're not going to want to miss hearing of what Natalie has to offer us today.
If you want the best way to heal from life challenges, get Erica Tucci's powerful book, Radiant Survivor, How to Shine and Thrive Through Recovery from Stroke, Cancer, Abuse, Addiction, and Other Life-Altering Experiences. Erica Tucci's remarkable book of healing is available now on Amazon. Find out more at www.radiantsurvivor.com.
You're tuned in Out on the Limb Radio with Dr. Nicola Bird. My next special guest is Natalie Berthold. Natalie is a family constellation therapist. Natalie works with family and ancestral patterns that have been passed down transgenerationally and that hold us back. Natalie will share tips on how to clear family patterns so we can be free to live our best life in health, in career, in finances, and in relationships. So I'm really happy to have Natalie here. Natalie, thank you for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Natalie, you are a new mommy.
I am a new mommy. I know you've been so patient with me. I had a baby about 5.5 weeks ago, so it's put new meaning in my family work for sure. Yeah.
Well, congratulations. I know you're a trooper, quite the lady.
Thank you.
Congratulations on, you know, being a mother. It's an incredible offering to the world, women's work in family. So
it's amazing.
That gets right into what our topic with you is, and the whole family dynamics and family. And it's very interesting how family has changed, because it's the first time that Americans ages 30 to 44 are more college-educated women than college-educated men.
Hmm.
So we've really changed and upset the traditional cleaver family dynamics. In 1970, women contributed 2 to 6% of the family income. Now, the typical working wife brings home 42.2%, and 4 in 10 mothers, many of them single mothers, are the primary breadwinners in their family. And the portion of American children born to unmarried parents jumped to 40% in the last few years. So, Natalie, you work with family constellation therapy, which we're going to learn about. First, we do want to know what that is. But that has to be, this impact on the changing roles of women and men must have an impact on this whole family dynamic. So, first, you can tell us about family, what family constellation therapy is, and then this whole, the roles of men and women, the changing roles, and how this impacts us and what we can do about it.
I mean, I could talk about it forever. I know we're limited. So first of all, I'm going to try to succinctly describe family constellation therapy, which is very hard because it is a phenomenological experiential therapy. So in other words, I could talk about it in theory. Usually it lands lightly, and then people experience it and they're like, wow, that was not what I was expecting. So in a nutshell, basically there are a lot of patterns that we adhere to, that we go to therapy for, that we are trying to explain or understand within the context of our own lives, when in fact many of them come from family and ancestral traumas, basically, and experiences and dynamics that existed before us that we're piggybacking on and repeating and repeating and repeating. And it's not always overt, like, oh, you know, mom had an eating disorder, so I had an eating disorder. Often it's very covert, roundabout, you know, hidden dynamics is what I work with. So when people are struggling with a same pattern over and over again, you know, they're always dating the married men, or they're always, maybe they lose a bunch of weight and then gain a bunch of weight, or they can never make money. No matter how much they're doing mantra work or their spiritual work or whatever, it's usually connected to a family or ancestral pattern that they're following. So in a nutshell, the work I do aims to sort of bring to light these hidden dynamics and to reorder them in the correct way and allow you to sort of live your own life instead of following this sort of seductive magnetic pull, which we're all involved in with our ancestors and family, out of love and loyalty. So nothing nefarious or anything like that. Again, that description doesn't even do it justice, but that's what it is in a nutshell.
We get a sense of what that is for sure.
Okay.
So we carry forth family patterns.
Correct.
And then how does that, and they said that so we can get stuck in family patterns that we may not be aware of. I mean, even though you're saying it's phenomenological and stuff like that, I mean, I know from having read about epigenetics and some of the studies around it that
right.
they do know that behaviors, learned behaviors, for instance, in a family can be expressed in genes up to two generations going forward, like, say, a grandfather. So it can be that gene, even though it's been developed in that, can actually be passed on. So there is some real logistics to what you're saying here in terms of, you know, what we can unconsciously have been part of our pool, so to speak.
Yeah. I mean, so, that's why I love it, because it is epigenetically based and factually based. Yeah. And even up to seven generations, they're showing. So, yes.
Mm. Okay. So that's really fascinating. So now that we're, like, going back to, because I think this is such a big part, and I was reading one of your blogs, which is really where I picked this up and started, you know, I was reading your blog on the male, the female, the father, the presence of men, and I know because we're having the changing roles and honoring that, and so that's where I go. That's why I started focusing on this particular topic.
Mm. Okay.
In terms of family dynamics changing, how does that affect then how we're experiencing or struggling in our lives, or what's passed down to us? Is it strictly genetic? Is it because we're exposed to certain behaviors in the environment? Is it both combined? Because then this would change then maybe some of what we are genetic, you know, familial or patterning.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think it's a combination of things in terms of roles specifically, and I'm not exactly sure what blog you're talking about, but in terms of roles specifically, you know, and it, studies show, at least with family constellation therapy, that people tend to do best and families tend to do best when the male is providing and leading and the mother is primarily taking care of the child. Circumstantially, you know, I'm staying home with my child and working at the same time. Circumstantially, a lot of families can't do that, nor do they necessarily want to. So roles have definitely shifted, you know, how families operate and how couples relate to one another and how couples find their worth and things like that. That is more sort of how you relate within your current family versus your family of origin, although certainly how your, you know, your mother and father did things affect how you and your partner do things. But yeah, certainly I think there's a combination between nature, nurture, family and ancestral dynamics, things like that. And I hope I'm answering your question, because I'm not sure exactly what what it was. But yeah.
Well, because what I'm trying to say is when you're talking about the family constellation and what's passed down, and,
right.
and in terms of what gets expressed, because of the changing roles, because, I mean, that's what most people are encountering now. We really do have changing roles in terms of what the family is. So we're no longer just, like you said, the traditional. So when we're having that, does that change then what gets passed down to us? Because if we're don't know our, you know, one parent as much or is not as involved, does that affect what gets passed down or what we end up struggling with?
I mean, it definitely does. And typically, actually, it's the, you know, a lot of people say, oh, well, I didn't even know my mom or dad or whatever. That's that person
right.
is going to affect
that's,
you more
because yeah.
you don't know that person. And it definitely does affect, you know, if you're a woman, you're mainly gaining your sphere of influence, we call it, from your mother, right? So you might be lacking some of the feminine gifts and feminine qualities that allow you to turn fully towards a partner And certainly, I mean, really with family constellations, what we do is look for missing pieces or that whatever separate in a family system, what's missing in a family system, what's unreconciled, what's still unhealed, where the trauma is, more so than, say, the roles or gender roles in your family system. Those are more, I guess, obvious, not obvious, but you could kind of work through that on your own and understand the correlation between the gender roles and sort of what is affecting you now. We're more looking at, although definitely has an effect on how you move forward. I guess we're more looking at what's unresolved or in the family system, what's unreconciled, what's separate still, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so I guess what I'm saying here is that if I don't know a parent,
right,
is this is still passed down.
That can have delirious effects. I mean, if you don't know a parent, so basically, in a nutshell, also family constellation comes about because we're so bonded and love and loyal. We have so much love and loyalty towards our parents, right? They gave us life. We're indebted to them out the wazoo, even if we think we hate them. So the child who never met their mom because they were given up for adoption and thinks, you know, F you, mom, like you didn't care about me or whatever, will be strikingly similar in most cases to their mother of origin, their biological mother, because this woman gave her life. And as much as you want to say, oh, I don't know her or I have nothing to do with her, we often really mimic the patterns because on a soul level, which is deeper than the mental level, we really want to bond and connect with that woman. So oftentimes it is the parent that you least know that has the most effect in passing down patterns. Yes.
So I guess, how are they passed on if they're so unconscious? Is it genetic? Is it energetic? What is it?
I mean, it is, I think, a combination of all those things. So it's more epigenetic, I think, than genetic, but it is energetic as well. And again, on a soul level, so the word kind of constellation, it sort of sounds sort of esoteric or woo-woo, but it's basically like, you know, you're born into a system, a family system, and everyone has their place, just like the stars in the constellation. And if one of those people is missing or there's unresolved trauma or there's, you know, separation, which certainly happens if you don't know your parent, right? There's extreme break in the bond and separation. You will go to that place energetically, and the souls just naturally come into the world and want to resolve that which is separate, that which is still unresolved. And so you immediately go to that place, and you, in good hopes of reconciling it or creating solutions or resolutions, you sort of typically get caught in quicksand and repeat the patterns. And it happens because subconsciously you're so loyal and so connected to your family system and have really good intentions of trying to heal it. So it is, I think it's one of the things I love about this therapy, because when I came into it, I was teaching engineering, so I was very mathematical and scientific. And even after 7-8 years of doing this therapy, it's still not fully explainable. So I can't say, well, it's definitely energetic or epigenetic. I think it's a combination of things, and also just things we can't really explain about how family systems work that's so beautiful and deep, and we don't really understand exactly, you know, how it works.
Well, I think that maybe so one of the questions that the listeners would be having right now is, like, if this is so unconscious, if it's so deeply embedded, like, then how do we become aware of it? How do we? So it's because, I mean, that's why I'm talking about, like, here's your environment, here is this, and you're talking about something that supersedes it or overrides it or is another layer of our existence. How do we, get to know how to be there with it and get to know and connect with it?
I guess because for someone like me, right, who's been studying it for a really long time, there are certain propensities and certain dynamics that correlate with certain traumas within the family system. So if I'm working with you, and I don't want to like say, oh, you can only heal it by working with a therapist, but certainly understanding how family dynamics work in correlation with how they manifest into patterns, is helpful, and then knowledge is power. Like it gives you the mobility to do it a little differently. You know, once it's brought to light, it's like, oh, I don't have to follow all them in that way. You know, I can substitute, you know, following addiction for, you know, bonding with them through their generosity or something like that. And it doesn't mean you have to study it for years and years and years, but really starting to understand, first of all, that, hey, maybe all of this isn't mine. And let me look into my history and see kind of where, and again, it's not so easy for the average person because it doesn't correlate directly necessarily. Like I said, it's not like, oh, I'm an alcoholic, my dad's an alcoholic, duh. Like there's the loyalty that can happen, but there are many nuances and many ways it can happen. And I would just say, you know, once that clicks, like when I work with a client, it clicks in a way where it just makes sense. They get it. It makes sense. Their soul doesn't reject it. You know, then I know I've hit the jackpot.
How would they know, for instance, again, like that this could be it? Like, what would we look for?
Would
we look for to suggest that it could be something in terms of these the family constellation?
Well, I mean, so like I said, I typically work with the client who has been repeating the same pattern over and over again. That's what I look for or tell them to look for. This is not for someone who like recently started having money problems or recently started dating married men or whatever. It's typically someone who has repeats something over and over again or just feels like they've exhausted all their other resources. You know, they've been in therapy forever. They're doing mantra work, whatever. And then I'm like, hey, it's probably connected to your family system. And I wish I had a more concrete way of saying how I figure it out. When I work with someone, it's a combination of knowledge of understanding, you know, the 100-plus family dynamics that can affect us and how they affect us. So using that, and then just intuitively when I work with someone. And then once we do the energy work behind it, again, there's just a relief that the soul has. They start breathing easier. It makes sense. Me, for example, I experienced the therapy for the first time. I had a 15-year eating disorder, right? And I had tried everything, including blaming my parents and all of that stuff that was really plausible. When I experienced this therapy and understood the dynamic behind it, I immediately stopped binging and purging. You know, my soul really recognized it as truth, and it resonated with me. I didn't reject it. The behavior didn't continue. It made sense for me. So I would, you know, it's different. Go ahead.
Are there, when you say there are 100-plus family dynamics, are there ones that, just for the listeners, so that they might be able to go, this might fit me, are there ones that are more common, that you might see turn up more prevalently? Are there the top three, for instance, that you...
Yeah, and it depends on what the client is coming to me with, right? But certainly, you know, people missing in the family system are separated, so that can be a wide variety. It's adoption, it's, you know, you never met your parents, it's someone was institutionalized, someone was in prison, someone was murdered, a sibling died, an abortion, someone got hit by a car, someone was retarded and really discarded from the family. Someone was estranged from the family. There's a million ways that someone can be sort of missing from the family system, right? So that's very common. Unresolved trauma, okay. Go ahead.
Right. So basically, the absence of would be one possible that would create a break or a conflict that could lead to the patterns that you see repeating and don't know why they're being repeated.
Exactly.
So that's
and pretty much everyone has someone that's absent if you consider all those things I just mentioned.
Right, yes. Yes, and it's been, again, because we're also having the changing roles of family now with so many, you know, single mothers and things like that, so that we have we're going to have the more, we can see that in that way in our society at this point as well. Okay, so that's one. So then you talk about trauma.
Yeah, and trauma could fit all those as well, right? But it could be, again, murder, rape, someone dying prematurely. I mean, trauma could be moving a lot. Trauma could be an abusive parent, alcoholism. It could, you know, one person's trauma is not another person's trauma. So trauma could exist on many, many levels. And again, not just your trauma, but your family trauma, right? Your mom's trauma, your dad's trauma, your grandparents' trauma. So certainly that is very common in people's family systems. There's a big rejection of the parent is a huge conflict, right? If you are angry at your parent, one or more of your parents, or you reject them, or even if you're out of order, meaning parentification is taking place, you're your mother's mother, or, you know, you don't see them as your mother, or you think you're better than, or even on the opposite spectrum where you're so afraid to surpass them, and their wealth and their health and all that, which happens quite a bit. So there, that's fairly common. So there's
okay,
just...
Well, we actually, yeah, we got the three, which I appreciate because we're going to have
okay.
to wrap up now. So we got three amazing tips that for the listeners to them to be aware of how this can play out in their lives and so that they can have more consciousness. So to find out more about Natalie and... She's. You can find your link in the website below, but her website is Natalie Berthold, that's BERTHOLD.com. She works with anyone wherever you are, so you certainly can connect with Natalie and access her work. And she has, there's another link here where she's offering listeners $300 off the price with the link, so you can click on that below. So there's lots that Natalie is doing. So, Natalie, thank you so much for your time, all of your information, and making us aware of some of the things that might be getting in the way of us living our best life possible.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so, wow, we've had a great show in terms of awareness and techniques and skills for us creating amazing lives. This is Dr. Nicola Bird, and you know, you can reach me at my website www.thewellness-network.com, and you can join my mailing list and share the joy with all your friends and family. And I have amazing people on this site, so you definitely want to check it out and sign up. Thank you for tuning in. As always, I'm Dr. Nicola Bird. See you right here tomorrow for another insightful and entertaining segment of Out on the Limb.
You're tuned into Out on the Limb Radio with Dr. Nicola Bird in partnership with Beauty and Wellness TV. Tune in Monday to Friday, 5 p.m. Eastern and 2 p.m. Pacific.